Abby Thatcher. And Abby Thatcher is a friend of Bill's. And Abby knew Bill because the Thatchers had a home in Manchester, Vermont, which is right across from East Dorset, Vermont. And they did a lot of drinking together. They knew each other well. And the bottom line is that Abby and Bill did a tremendous amount of drinking together, as I say, but Lois was not crazy about the fact that Abby was coming over. Because Abby coming over usually meant that these two were going to get drunk. And Abby comes over, and he's at the door of 182 Clinton Street, and he is, well, I'll let the book explain. You don't need me to explain. I'll let the book explain what's going on here. Okay.
Excuse me.
Yes.
What page are you on?
I'm on page 8 at the bottom. 8. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. That's in italics. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course he would have dinner. Then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility. The very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there, fresh skin and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it, disappointed but curious. I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me, simply but smilingly. He said, I've got religion. I was aghast, so that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot, now I suspected a little crack about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court, persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass his experience along to me, dash, new thought, if I cared to have it. I was shocked, but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. Remember that hopeless means I'm out of ideas. I'm out of ideas. He thought for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I was could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on Still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proper temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folks and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music, but his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. That wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again. So Bill is thinking about that grave that he saw, that doggerel, about a guy who drank himself to death. I had always believed in a power. Look at your capital letters here. When he's capitalizing, he's talking about God. Greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher. A cipher is a nothing. It's an empty set and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists, suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much a precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe, Gabriel. We knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I got, as I had gone. With ministers and the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength and direction, I became irritated. My mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ I conceded. the certainty of a great man, not too closely followed by those who claimed him, his moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts which seemed convenient and not too difficult, the rest I disregarded. So we see Bill being presented with a spiritual solution to his problem, and he's fighting against it, just like most of us do. Even people who are highly religious, I have seen rabbis, nuns, priests, ministers, deacons, lay people, church officials, synagogue officials, in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous, struggle with this idea. I've seen people who attend church or synagogue every chance they get, struggle with this idea. Why? Because we are spending time as sponsors on food plans, which is important. We need to do that. That's good work, and we need to do that. But we're not spending enough time helping people develop a concept of a higher power that they are willing to believe in. We are not looking at this, and we're not seeing people suffering because they have a concept of a higher power that is adversarial to them. They believe that God has screwed them over. Now, I told you when I first came here that God was the enemy of my dad. My dad was the sole survivor of religious persecution in Europe. And that he was the sole survivor of a family of 40 people who were obliterated off the face of the earth. And for what reason? No reason. None. They were bothering no one. And they were murdered. So this didn't go well with my dad. And he went to synagogue because that's what he knew to do. And when he would walk out of the house and we would start walking down the street to the synagogue, which is right on the corner, he'd go because he was so mad at God. He would spit on the floor. That's how mad he was. That's how mad he was. And you couldn't shake him out of it. And he lived that way his whole life. My mother was crazy, but my mother told me some things that were true. And my mother would say to me, you can't think like him or you're going to live like him. And if you live like him, you'll have no life. What happened to him doesn't have to happen to you. And now they're doing a lot of work that the trauma of generations before us is in ourselves. It's in our molecules. It's in ourselves. This trauma that he withstood is in me, and I have to work at it constantly. But what we need to do, what I need to do when I sponsor, is help people come to a definition of a higher power that they are willing to believe in. And this is integral, because without that, it's very difficult to turn your will and life over to the care of God when you do not believe that God is going to take care of you. Now, does that mean that God is going to become Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy and just grant your wishes like a genie? No. And many of us have questions like, why my mother, why my father, why my child, why my sister, why my job, why my husband, why my wife? And I'm going to tell you, I don't know. I don't know why some children are born with leukemia. I don't know why some children are stillborn. I don't know why some people have a hard time conceiving and others don't. I don't know why some people live to be 100 and some people live to be 21. I don't know. I don't have a clue. I'm not going to pretend that I do know. But what I do know is, when you were raped, or you were molested, or you were hurt, or you were abandoned, or you were brutalized physically, God was crying with you, because it's a world of people that have free will. God didn't put a bunch of robots on the earth. He put people with free will. And some people are going to choose to do terrible things. Terrible. I don't know why. And we're hurting. But if we don't heal our wounds, we're going to bleed on people that didn't cut us. If we don't heal our wounds, we're going to bleed on people that didn't cut us. And our bodies have been crying the tears that our eyes have refused to shed. And we've been tantruming with a knife and a fork. And raging against a past that cannot be changed. It's time to stop. I know you're pissed off. What, you want to let it kill you? You have a disease. You have a disease of the mind, you have a disease of the body, and you can't beat it on your own. You're going to need God's help. So you might as well get one in your heart that you are willing to believe in. Is that pissed off? Is that the hill you want to die on? You want to let it go, huh? You're going to let that go, huh? Your dad was a putz. No doubt. You going to let it kill you? Because you got no other choice. Is this the hill you want to die on? How far do you want to take it? You've taken it decades and decades and decades now, and you're not gaining any ground. How many candy bars do you want to eat? How many blood tests do you want to come back? Not what you want. How many times do you want to hurt? You're fighting against yourself. It's time to let it go. The wars which had been fought, the burnings, the chicanery that religious dispute had facilitated made me sick. This paragraph is as timeless as it gets. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible, the brotherhood of man a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. But my friend sat before me and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. If it can happen for Abby, it can happen for you. It can happen for you. Let it go. Let it go. It's time. Is it ever too late to do the right thing for yourself?
No.
Is it ever too late to give yourself the break that you've needed for 35 years? You're helping no one. They're dead. They're gone. They're divorced. They've moved on. How far do you want to take it? Without a power greater than yourself that you're willing to believe in, you're not going to recover. Want me to say that again?
Yeah.
Without a power greater than yourself that you're willing to believe in. Nobody says you have to believe. You just have to be willing to believe. That's all. You don't have to believe a damn thing. You just have to be willing to believe that there's a power greater than yourself. Are you so egotistical that you think you created Lake Michigan and the other Great Lakes? Really? Did you ever look out at Lake Michigan in the morning when the sun's coming up? Wow. Wow. My God, what a sight. Now, if you've never been to Chicago, you've seen it a million times in movies and TV shows and all kinds of stuff. Beautiful. My God, how do you remember the five Great Lakes homes? Huron, Ontario, Michigan, Erie, and Superior. That's how you remember it, the little acronym. Huron, Ontario, Michigan, Erie, and Superior homes. And that just happens to be where we live in Chicago, it's right on the Great Lakes. This is a beautiful part of the country here in Yuma, Arizona. You're right on the Colorado River, you're right in that area there where Arizona meets Mexico and meets California. It's a beautiful part of the country. Boy, you're driving up here, or driving over here, man, it's gorgeous. My God, is it beautiful. The mountains and the fields, and you see the farms, the agriculture, I mean, it's just beautiful. You ever think about how, what a beautiful part of the country you live in over here in Yuma? Beautiful. My God. You're very lucky. Who created all this? You? It was here before you got here. It'll be here long after you're gone. You didn't create this. It's time to let it go. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. The biggest miracle I've ever seen in my life is an alcoholic or a compulsive overeater, a drug addict or gambler not practicing their addiction and doing so happily. I've seen a lot of miracles. I've seen a lot of miracles, but I've never seen one that could equal that. Each and every one of you is a miracle. I don't know what you got in your car in terms of food. I don't know what you ate this morning. I don't know what you're going to eat later on. But right now, I'm looking at a room full of compulsive overeaters, and there isn't one of you that's compulsively overeating at this moment. And that is a miracle, that a room full of sick people cannot practice their illness at this moment at 11 o'clock exactly on the 15th of February, 2020, on a beautiful, God-given, blessed Saturday morning here in Yuma, Arizona.
Amen.
What a beautiful place it is, too. My God. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped the new soil. I could talk for hours on that, but it would take us out of the ballgame. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy. Antipathy means a feeling of dislike. When the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me, this feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" That statement opened the door to people that will not be born for 20,000 years to walk through the doors of an Overeaters Anonymous meeting and say, I can be here too. If this was a Christian program, I couldn't be here. If it was a Jewish program, I or you maybe couldn't be here. If it was a whatever program, it would exclude. But now the door is wide open to everyone. Be you Catholic, Protestant, Jewish, Buddhist, whatever you are, whoever, atheist, agnostic, you are welcome here. Jimmy Burwell was an atheist, and he recovered from his alcoholism. All that was required of him was to believe that there was a power greater than himself. It doesn't have to be a religious deity. If you are an agnostic, and what is the difference between an atheist and an agnostic? An atheist believes that there is no God. An agnostic, ag means without, gnostic means knowledge. They don't have knowledge. They don't know whether there is one or not. And then a believer believes that there is a God. That's all. That's all. That's all it is. If you're an atheist, or you're an agnostic, or you're a religious person, or you're a believer, or whatever it is you are, because we have this statement, God, why don't you choose your own conception of God? You are welcome here. and you are one of us. No matter what your leanings are, you are one of us. That statement opened up the door. Okay? That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. I saw, now the beginning is step three. Step three is a beginning and a decision. So we're talking about the history of step two. And we're talking about choosing your own God and coming to believe that that power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. It doesn't say we believe. It says we came to believe. That means it's a process. So if you wake up tomorrow and you're not quite there, that's okay. Keep working toward it. And how do you work toward that? Keep doing your steps. Keep helping others. Stop waiting for willingness. Willingness is the most overrated concept we have. It is BS. If I was waiting for willingness, I'd be dead. I would have been dead 30 years ago. Stop waiting for willingness. It's an overrated, archaic concept. You know how you get willing? By taking action. Stop waiting. Take action. This is not a program for people who need it. It is not a program for people who want it. It's a program for people who do it. And when you take that action, the willingness will come. It's not the other way around for most people. I do not get struck in the morning by this overwhelming God consciousness. The God consciousness comes when I help others. I woke up this morning, 4:30 in the morning, with somebody that needed a 10-step. And then I woke up again, somebody needed to talk. They have cancer. They live in Northern California, and they're a dear friend in program, and she's just been diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. And she's scared, and she needed to talk. What am I going to do? Say, I'm sleeping. Call me back. No, you get up and you take the call. Before you pray and before you do step 11 in the morning, you take that call from somebody with triple negative breast cancer who's scared to death. That comes first. Before anything and everything. And she's helped a lot of people, and she's worked hard in this program. And she's scared, and she's in trouble. That's how you get willing to believe. Not the other way around. Not that I'm so wonderful, or I'm just telling you what I do. I'm sharing my life with you, not to show you, oh, look at me, I'm so wonderful. No. There are going to be people with cancer that need to call you, not me, because you have a relationship with them that I don't have. God's got a job for you. But you cannot get to that place of a constant companionship with your higher power without taking action, in my experience. You just can't. Upon a foundation of, I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. You want to recover. Let it go. Let it go. You got to let it go. You've been tantruming with a knife and a fork for years. If you don't heal your wounds, you're going to bleed on people that didn't cut you. And in the end, you're going to hurt yourself. Haven't you suffered enough? Haven't you eaten enough? Haven't you been ashamed enough? You know, I told you when I got here, I hope I did, I don't remember, that most of the adults that I knew as a child came out of the concentration camps with the tattoos on their arms from the camps. Live until you die is what they would tell me. Live until you die. What does that mean? That you maximize your life until God takes you out of the ballgame. That you maximize your life, and sitting there tantruming is not the way to do it. Let's continue. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last I saw, I felt, I believed. Saw, felt, believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. The real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me for a brief moment. I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself, and so it had been ever since, how blind I had been. You worried about how much money you're going to make, or the new car you think you would fix you, or something? God will take care of you. You may not get a Maserati, you may not get a Rolls Royce, but you'll get something that'll get you around, even to take people to meetings. You can get yourself to meetings. Don't worry about what you don't have. Stop telling God how big your problems are. Stop telling your problems how big your God is. At the hospital, now, December 11th, 1934, Bill Wilson is going to be admitted to the town's hospital for the third time and final time. And on the 14th, after 2 days of sobriety, the 12th and the 13th, he's going to start working the steps. After 2 days of sobriety, we're going to get this two-day reference several times in the big book. You don't need a month of sobriety. You don't need a year of sobriety. You need 2 days and you can start working the steps. I'm not looking at my watch because I'm bored. I'm looking at my watch because I'm 65 and I can't read your clock. At the hospital, I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. There I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time that of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. That means he's worked what we know today as steps 1, 2, and 3. I ruthlessly faced my sin, step 4, and became willing to have my newfound friend, notice friend is capital, he's talking about God, take them away root and branch, 6 and 7. So he's done 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7. I have not had a drink since. My schoolmate visited me, Ebby, and I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies, step 5. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment, 8. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong, 9. Never was I to be critical of them, 10. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. So he's worked the first 10 steps. Now he's going to work step 11. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself except as my request for and my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. Step 11. My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. This is not just about your food or your liquor. This is everything. We don't just turn our will and our life over to care of God and say, except for money, except for sex, except for... We turn everything over to God. Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. Bill always maintained that in the town's hospital in December of 34,
he had a white light experience where God was concerned. He was in the room, and God came into the room, and his life was changed forever. I have had no such experience. Mine was a spiritual awakening that came about very slowly over time. But they're both fine. They're both fine. For a moment, I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor, that's Silkworth, to ask if I was still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head, saying, "Something has happened to you I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were." The good doctor now sees many men who have such experiences. He knows they are real. While I lay in the hospital, now you got to remember before we get into this next paragraph, Bill is a selfish, drunk son of a bitch. But what happened as a result of his spiritual experience? Now listen, while I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. So he's thinking of others probably for the first time in his adult life. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. And there's your step 12. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Now again, Ebby is stressing to him how important it is to work with others, and I'm going to lay another thing on you here. If you don't work with others, you will not recover. Not going to happen. I'm going to say it two more times. I want you to forget it as soon as you walk out of here. I don't want you to retain this information at all. I want this completely forgotten. Don't you dare write it down. If you don't work with other people, you will not recover. If you don't work with other people, you will not recover. It's not going to happen, not in this lifetime. You're scared to sponsor? I'd be scared not to. You let the book do 99% of the work for you. I have a 100% recovery rate in my sponsorship. I recover 100% of the time, but they don't. Don't worry about results, and don't worry about what people are going to think of you. You know what we're going to think of you? Nothing. Nothing. It's not about results. Results means I'm in the Al-Anonic condition. I must work with others. When I had a spiritual awakening, not when I'm on step 2 or 3 or 7. You work with others when you've had a spiritual awakening, and you're at step 12. That's when you start working with others, not before. But that shouldn't take very long. You can work with others. You can be successful with some of them where others cannot. And if you fail with most of them, they have a name for that. It's called normal. It's called normal. Faith without works was dead, he said, and how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again. If he drank, he would surely die. And faith would be dead indeed with us. It is just like that. You owe. You owe. You got a debt. An unbroken chain between Bill Wilson and you. An unbroken chain between Dr. Bob and you. And every link along the chain passed it to the next, and the next, and the next, and the next. We're going to go over that more this afternoon. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping others. Other alcoholics, to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. You call me up, you're having a bad day. First question out of my mouth is, what have you done today for somebody else? Get out of yourself, get out of yourself, get out of yourself. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. I'm talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in a rough going. And that's what this is. We commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown up among us, of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part.
Remember when he was, became the lone wolf? He's not a lone wolf anymore. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty, I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in the path that really goes somewhere, have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted, fumes and bitternesses of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us. In one western city, Akron, and its environs, there are 1,000 of us and our families. We meet frequently so the newcomers might find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seemingly worldliness and levity, but just underneath there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through it, or we perish. Again, there's your warning. Work with others or you won't recover. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth and goodwill to men. Bill Wilson died on January the 24th, 1971. Now we have one of two choices if we are finished with Bill's story. I can either get a little bit of a start on chapter 5, which I think we should do, or we can take some questions and answers. What do you want to do, Bob?
We've got it.
Let's do Q&A,
and we'll say chapter 5 for that long. Is that what you want to do? I always feel in the afternoon like I got to keep watching that clock. So, okay, let's take a couple more questions. And let's not do a lot of, let's not do three questions. We need to take that to some of the professional. Okay. I had a question earlier. Thank you. Yeah. I'm Tommy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tommy.
Hi, Tommy.
I have some friends that I'm thinking about the OA program. And as we were going through this, a question came to me. And I talked a little bit about the break. Do people in OA, do they drink? No. I don't. Some do. I don't know. I don't. I don't feel liquor is an appropriate part of my abstinence because A, it's loaded with sugar, and B, it lowers the inhibitions. So to me, it's not a part of an abstinence that I would recognize as abstinence. If you have a religious reason why you need to do it, whatever, I don't know. I don't. There may be people here who would disagree, but I don't feel that liquor, wine, beer is a part of any abstinence of which I'm comfortable. If that's a personal, I'm just answering for me.
I can say I drink at least a glass of wine every month or two, but if that caused me problems, if my cravings came back, I wouldn't.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yes.
Can you give me the names of some of those giants just so I can...
We'd be here all day. There's so many giants, it's not even funny. Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob, Dr. Silkworth, Jimmy Burwell, Fitz Mayo, A.G. Ainsworth, Roseanne Scholar. The list goes on and on and on. Bill Dotson, let's not forget Bill Dotson, Archie Throwbridge, Earl Treats, Sylvia Kaufman, Martin Mann. The list just goes on and on. Clarence Snyder, for sure, Clarence Snyder.